Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, like all discrimination, Islamophobia is political and personal, individual and institutional, subtle and not at all subtle. A recent incident led Maha Hilal to connect those dots in an essay. Maha Hilal is co-director of the Justice for Muslims Collective and an organizer with Witness Against Torture. We'll talk with her about her piece, White Supremacy in the Courtroom, and the story behind it. Also on the show, if you search endangered species online, you will find many beautiful photographs of foxes and leopards and bears. If the Trump White House has its way, pictures may be all that you can see. We spoke with Brett Hartle, Government Affairs Director at the Center for Biological Diversity, about the current assaults on the Endangered Species Act. That's all coming up, but first, a quick look back at recent press. As of July 2nd, it has been a calendar year since nominal liberal network MSNBC has aired a segment mentioning U.S. participation in the war on Yemen, which has killed more than 15,000 people and resulted in over a million cases of cholera. The U.S. is backing a Saudi-led bombing campaign with intelligence, refueling, political cover, military hardware, and as of March, ground troops. But as Adam Johnson notes for Fair.org, none of that seems to rate with what Adweek calls the network of the resistance, which has, since its last mention of the U.S.'s role in the destruction of Yemen, run over a dozen segments highlighting war crimes committed by the Syrian and Russian governments in Syria and more than 400 segments on Stormy Daniels. Can it be done? Well, yes. The PBS NewsHour just ran a three-part series on the war. The second part was headlined, American-Made Bombs in Yemen Are Killing Civilians, Destroying Infrastructure, and Fueling Anger at the U.S. So it's hard to imagine MSNBC editors thinking deeply and concluding that Trump's war in Yemen isn't newsworthy. It's much easier to picture them deciding that Russia and scandal are easy sells. And anyway, Yemenis aren't going to pull ads, turn down appearances, or phone Comcast higher-ups with complaints. And in the Everything Old is New Again department, Dean Baker calls our attention to Roger Lowenstein in the Washington Post, offering readers of his business section perspective the following pearl. Quote, "But what if inequality is the wrong metric? Here with a modest proposition. Economic inequality is not the best yardstick. What we should be paying attention to is social mobility." Close quote. Baker fails to find the novelty, given that right-wingers have been pushing that line since the dawn of time. Don't worry that your standard of living is awful. The important thing is that your kids will be able to get rich. Well, the point of this particular iteration comes when you read, quote, "It's also far from proved, to me it's not even intuitive, that high incomes on Wall Street and elsewhere are the reason for, say, flatter wages in manufacturing. The fact that Mark Zuckerberg is so rich is annoying, and his separateness from Main Street may not be a great thing socially, but in an economic sense, his fortune did not come from the paychecks of ordinary workers." Close quote. Well, Dean Baker explains that, actually, people who get incredibly wealthy from exploiting monopolies and avoiding taxes do attain that wealth at the expense of others. And with productivity growing at an incredibly slow rate for the last dozen years or so, it seems like in aggregate, these incredibly rich folks are much better at generating wealth for themselves than for the economy as a whole. So what about structuring our economy so that it makes less difference whether someone ends up at the top, like Jeff Bezos, or at the bottom, earning minimum wage? That idea is apparently too simple for the great ponderers to ponder. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. anti-Muslim hatred, assaults, intimidation, vandalism have increased in this country since September 11, 2001, with investigation dishearteningly suggesting the sharpest spikes have been since 2015. Media play a role. New research illustrates what we already knew, that attacks labeled terrorist get volumes more coverage. One new study says 357% more coverage when the assailant can be connected with Islam. It's hard now to even measure what has been lost and willfully surrendered in the so-called war on terror. One way is to look at Guantanamo Bay, where hundreds of Muslim men and boys were held and dozens remain, subject to torture, most never even charged with a crime. Just as Guantanamo is not just a prison, but a representation of state violence and lawlessness, sometimes an incident, as one reported recently by our next guest, can represent the intersecting layers of injustice that make up Islamophobia. Maha Hilal is co-director of Justice for Muslims Collective and an organizer with Witness Against Torture. She joins us now by phone from Arlington. Welcome back to Counterspin, Maha Hilal.
Thank you so much, Janine.
Well, I would just ask you, if you would, to tell the story of July 11th when you went to the U.S. District Court in D.C. Why were you there, first of all, and what happened?
Yeah, so I, you know, went to the court on the morning of July 11th, intending to hear the oral arguments in Elbihani versus Trump, a case that's based on the indefinite detention of 11 prisoners in Guantanamo Bay. And as you know, and probably many of your viewers know, there has been very little justice for prisoners at Guantanamo, particularly those who've remained in detention for over a decade now. So I was pretty excited about this, the oral arguments, and to really think about what justice could look like and perhaps if justice would come to the prisoners. And as a, you know, visible Muslim woman, I recognize that in many of these settings, you know, when I go into a space that's national security, that I inevitably invite scrutiny and oftentimes surveillance as well. So I went into the courtroom and I sat in the first row. And after doing so, the officer, his name was Officer Collins, came and told me that I needed to sit in the second row because the first row was reserved for attorneys. So I sat in the second row, and I had my phone out on my notebook, but I wasn't actively using the phone. And he then approached me and told me I needed to put it away, which I did. But I think I looked visibly annoyed when he made that request of me, but more so because of the context that I was in and, you know, being really anxious about the oral arguments that were about to happen. He then told me that I needed to follow him outside of the courtroom, so I did. And he told me that when he gives me an order, I need to listen to him and not give him attitude, and then said I was done for the day. And at that point, I was sort of in shock because I really didn't understand what behavior I had exhibited that would warrant this kind of treatment. It's not like I got up in the middle of the hearing and disrupted. I didn't make any noise. The only thing that I had done was to have an annoyed facial expression. And for me, standing there outside the courtroom thinking about, I was literally kicked out because I had a facial expression that this officer didn't like. And what does that mean for the amount of discretion these individuals have to pursue these rules that are really, when there is that much discretion, it means that you can use your discretion on people you don't like, right? And it means that those who you deem as not following the rules typically tend to be people of color. So for me, that was a shock, and also the fact that the officer was a person of color as well, and sort of not recognizing the many layers of irony in this situation.
Well, it pulls on so many different threads, which I'm guessing is why you wrote this essay for Truth Out, White Supremacy in the Courtroom. So many things are happening. There is the disjunct that's just, you know, hard to bear between your being, you know, charged and thrown out for the offense of giving attitude in this space where such immense inhumanity is present.
Right.
You know, this is a case about Guantanamo Bay. I mean, that disjunct is painful.
Yeah, it was. I mean, it was very painful.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just, again, the irony and knowing what was being heard in the courtroom that day. And, you know, it had been suggested to me that perhaps he wasn't aware of what the hearing was. And I find that hard to believe simply because of the fact that many of these issues that are heard in the courts often invite scrutiny in terms of protesting. So I would assume that officers who are placed in courtrooms where there might be some sort of protest will be informed of the content of the hearing.
Absolutely. And then there is the feeling that is so common for some of us of selective enforcement, of being singled out. And people always want to say, but you can't prove that they picked you because you're Black, for example. You can't, you know, even though everyone was talking and you were the one they said was loud, you know, you can't prove it. And it's just such a common, you know, daily feeling for some of us as we move through the world of being looked at a certain way, of being singled out, and particularly in situations where it's up against officialdom, you know, official power, which always has a latent violence behind it. You know, there always is when an officer yanks you out somewhere, it's hard not to feel the power disjunct between the two of you.
Yeah, and if they take a broader approach, I mean, the point of a lot of the ways that Muslims have been targeted is not just to target those in specific individuals. It's to send a message to the entire community that you too could be targeted, that you too will be surveilled, that you too will be profiled. So it's very frustrating when they then turn around and do that and act as if you're the one that doesn't know what's happening. And we know exactly what's happening, right? Those who are being targeted repeatedly and constantly know exactly what the state's agenda has been and is. And that's because that's what they have done time and time and time again.
Well, when we last spoke with you back in March, we were talking about Gina Haspel possibly being made head of the CIA. And then a few months later, in her confirmation hearing, we see a big New York Times headline, Gina Haspel, nominee for CIA, says era of torture is over. She talked about the interrogation program casting a shadow over what has been a major contribution to protecting this country. And it reminded me of something you said back in March, which was that there's not much point in having a debate about Gina Haspel, about her personal relationship to torture or her moral compass, that we have to be having the bigger conversation about the CIA itself.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the points that I kept reiterating in that discussion is, you know, there was this argument that was actually used on sort of the left / progressive side that she's not qualified to lead the CIA. But that ignores the whole entire history of the CIA. The CIA is a brutal institution of state violence. So in that way, she's very qualified to lead this organization. And, you know, it's very frustrating to be at this juncture in time when there is a lot of information, a lot of historical information, where we know what these institutions have been responsible for, right? You know, the thing I like to link it to now that this has come about, is the movement to abolish ICE. And I think that that's a very powerful statement, because we're acknowledging the reality that some institutions were designed to inflict massive state violence onto communities. So if we want to think about what it's going to take to stop that violence, it's not going to be about reforming these organizations. It's going to be about dismantling these organizations. And so I think that we have to be really critical about, especially from people of color, what are we asking for and what are the ways that we're actually going to get justice? And if similar institutions continue to exist, that's not going to happen.
Well, let me just ask you, finally, I'm very sorry that you didn't get to be in the courtroom for those oral arguments. What should we know about Al-Bihani versus Trump going forward? Because for reasons that we've only touched on, you know, there isn't going to be maybe the scrutiny on it that there should be. But what's going on there with that case?
Well, you know, it's interesting because on the side of the lawyers who are defending the prisoners, I mean, the argument is that you can't indefinitely detain people, right? There has to be an end to this nebulous war. On the government side, their argument was that you can continually detain people for as long as this war lasts, even if it's 100 years, and there is no set sort of deadline for when this might happen. And, you know, I think one of the problems here, when you're talking about the legal system post-9/11, which is, you know, the context that I examine in my research and writing, is that a lot of times you're not actually, at the end of the day, talking about legality and illegality. You're talking about who has the power to enforce a set of rules and laws, right? So what you have is people making very legitimate, sound arguments, but because the legal system is steeped in white supremacy, racism, anti-Blackness, Islamophobia, xenophobia, it becomes less about what the law actually is. Right. And especially when you can just rewrite the law, as we saw with the torture memo, for example. So it becomes less about what the law actually is and who has the power to enforce these very brutal, oppressive systems.
We've been speaking with Maha Lal, co-director of Justice for Muslims Collective and an organizer with Witness Against Torture. Her essay, White Supremacy in the Courtroom, Why I Was Booted from a Hearing on Guantanamo, can be found on truthout.org. Maha Lal, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you so much, Janine.
Like Social Security, the Endangered Species Act is, historically and presently, very popular. People, in the main, get the idea that trying not to wipe species off the face of the earth is a meaningful way to reflect the recognition that human life is sustained and enriched by a healthy and diverse environment. And, as with Social Security, there are some who see the Endangered Species Act as primarily an obstacle keeping them and their friends from making the maximum amount of money possible. The trouble is, too often, media seem to balance those perspectives in reporting on the act. Now the Trump administration is going all out to push back on central parts of the Endangered Species Act. What sort of reporting would make clear what's at stake and why we're in this fight in the first place? We're joined now for an update on things by Brett Hartle, Government Affairs Director at the Center for Biological Diversity. He joins us now by phone from Toronto. Welcome to Counterspin, Brett Hartle.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Well, this is a multi-front assault, as I understand it, from the Trump White House on regulations relevant to the Endangered Species Act. What are some of the pieces of what's going on right now?
Well, sure. And it's important to understand, like you said, that the Endangered Species Act is a remarkably successful and popular law. It has saved 99% of the species under its care from extinction. And the way it has done it is through a series of rules and safeguards that have been in place for nearly 45 years. And the Trump administration released three separate related proposals that collectively really just take a meat cleaver to those safeguards, to the rules that have so successfully saved endangered species. So it'll make it harder to protect them, to protect their habitats. It'll make the protections they receive weaker. And like you said, it will also rubber stamp and streamline a lot of really dangerous projects, all in the name of benefiting special interests at the expense of endangered wildlife.
Well, here's the Washington Post quoting Fish and Wildlife Service Deputy Director Greg Sheehan. Quote, we are proposing these improvements, these are what they call the changes, we are proposing these improvements to produce the best conservation results for the species while reducing the regulatory burden on the American people, close quote. Now, there's no explication of that empty phrase, but the piece then quotes a lawyer for the conservative law firm, the Pacific Legal Foundation, and he says, quote, the modest reform proposed by the Department of Interior today could finally enable the Endangered Species Act to achieve both of its noble goals of preventing extinctions and promoting recovery of protected species. Relaxing regulations as a species recovers will reward property owners for their role in that recovery, creating a necessary incentive for landowners to restore and improve endangered species habitat, close quote. Well, I'm going to ask you to respond to the idea that weakening the act strengthens the act, but I want to say also it bugs me anyway that the issue is still presented in this some say others differ format. It's like an argument preserved in amber, you know, as though there's no evidence to consider this question of does protecting species kill the American dream or whatever.
Yeah.
So how do we parse this argument that we're hearing here?
Sure. And you know, I mean, I think you're right. Kudos to the other side for really winning the rhetorical war in most of the media. You know, they make it seem like it's an even-handed debate and the people are split when, in fact, I don't think most people, even Trump voters, thought that gutting protections for endangered species was the reducing regulatory burdens that they had in mind. You know, first, it's important to understand that the Endangered Species Act has always not only incentivized good behavior on private property, rewarded private property owners as species recover, provided enormous flexibility to allow reasonable development to occur as long as we mitigate and then minimize the harm that we cause endangered species. But more broadly, I mean, I think it's important to really understand that when they talk about making the act work better, it's just code. It's code for them to basically say, we're giving a green light and a rubber stamp to things like drilling offshore and drilling in the Arctic and mining for coal everywhere. There's nothing reasonable or moderate within these proposals, for example, where they simply say, we are no longer going to protect critical habitat for endangered species that are harmed by climate change. And we're not going to assess the impacts of climate change on endangered species ever again. That's not even remotely reasonable. Reducing the protections for threatened species is basically saying, like, well, if you were in the hospital and you were recovering from a bad injury or a bad illness, and halfway through we said, well, you know what? We're just going to, you know, get rid of your medications and just assume that because you're on the right track today, it's just going to keep going well. You don't end a treatment for a serious illness halfway through because things are going well. You finish the treatment, you get yourself to recovery, and then you move forward. Basically, what we're going to see is hundreds of endangered species that were on the right track, moving towards recovery, moving back to healthy populations, get derailed and be sort of like stuck in limbo or purgatory for years to come.
Well, Obama did it too, is a popular parlor game, and it's important to see where there's a continuity of policy and impact, even if there's been an evident change in personality or in approach. Well, you've been working on this issue for years, including within Congress. Does what we're seeing now represent a break or an escalation or what? How would you differentiate this administration's actions on this issue?
I'd certainly be the first to agree that, you know, no administration is perfect and that the Obama administration fell short, too, in critical areas. But this is far more sweeping, what the Trump administration is doing, than any other president has tried before. It really just, it goes far beyond the realms of, you know, the reasonable policy disagreements that normal governments have when parties shift. So I think it's a pretty dramatic escalation. It certainly aligns well with what the Republican majorities in Congress are doing right now, which is relentlessly attacking every aspect of the Endangered Species Act under the same, you know, rhetorical guise of regulatory reform, when it really is just about rewarding special interests and the largest polluters and their sort of richest friends. So it's in some ways more of the same, but in some ways this is actually extremely dangerous and unprecedented, and hopefully, you know, the American people will speak out against it.
Well, I wanted to say about media, I don't think it's that they don't acknowledge that there's powerful corporate interests at work here. It just feels like they lend, and this is what you're talking about, the balance. It seems like they lend legitimacy to the argument that protecting species conflicts with business and with jobs. And I think partly they do that by painting it as a values thing. You know, it's elite and out of touch to care about, if not the environment, individual species. You know, we remember when spotted owl was just itself a punchline, you know, and then it's very salt of the earth to want to cut red tape and all of that. And I think some journalists, you know, who are the same ones going on about the heartland may buy into that when, if they talk to actual conservatives of a certain stripe, they'd hear something very different than the argument that they're kind of putting in a lot of folks' mouths, wouldn't they?
Yeah, I mean, there is a lot of rhetoric and a lot of, you know, demagoguing and scapegoating that unfortunately happens to some endangered species. They become, unfortunately, you know, and wrongly, the target of a lot of anti-federal government feelings and sentiments because they're easy to demonize. And, you know, special interests learned long ago that it's probably better to villainize them than to try to explain the complexities of our, you know, supposedly free markets, when in fact there's many other reasons that, you know, drive a lot of these economic questions. So, you know, spotted owls, sage grouse, wolves have always been blamed for very complex problems, and they're not responsible, but they're easy to pick on. And unfortunately, the media buys into it sometimes. But the reality is that, you know, we have over 1,800 endangered species in the United States. 99% have been saved from extinction. Many are on a path to recovery. And we have been able to do that for decades while also accommodating, you know, reasonable development. So it's not incompatible. And the reality is that healthy, thriving wildlife benefits people enormously, just as healthy environments do, because we depend on things like clean air and clean water and healthy wildlife to thrive as a society.
I just think even some conservatives are being misrepresented here, you know, even who would define themselves as conservatives who are actually conservationists as well.
Yeah.
Well, finally, we've been saying that people don't seem to accept these arguments. People support the Endangered Species Act overwhelmingly. What do you see happening over the next few days? What are you going to be doing, and what can folks be doing?
Well, so right now, these are all proposed changes to existing regulations, and that means that there's a public comment period. It's going to go on for 60 days till about late September, and any person, it's at your right as a citizen, to write or email and express your opposition or your thoughts about this. The government has to at least acknowledge them and respond. And, you know, we will be doing that. And, you know, if the Trump administration continues to push many of these changes, which are harmful to the Endangered Species Act and probably illegal, just like many of the other rollbacks that we are seeing across the board, you know, we will go to court, and I think ultimately we will prevail.
We've been speaking with Brett Hartle, Government Affairs Director at the Center for Biological Diversity. Find their work online at biologicaldiversity.org. Brett Hartle, thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks a lot. Have a good week.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. For more information, you can check out our website. It's FAIR.org. The show is engineered by Erica Rosato. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.